Thank you. All lines are now bridged.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the USCDI Task Force meeting. We will call the meeting to order, starting with roll call. Cristina Caraballo.
I'm here.
Okay. Terry O'Malley.
Here.
Stephen Lane.
Here.
Clint McDonald.
Here.
Brett Oliver. Brett here. Ken Kawamoto.
Here.
Valerie Gray. No Valerie. Laura Heerman-Langford.
Here.
Hi, Laura. Leslie Kelly Hall.
Here.
Nancy Beaven. Not yet. Kim Nolan.
Hi, I'm here.
Hi, Kim. Rich Elmore.
Here.
Eric Heflin. Not yet. Dan Breeman. Not yet. Mike Peretta.
Here.
And I do believe Rob Housay is absent today. So with that, I will turn it over to Cristina and Terry.
Great. Hello, everybody, and thanks for joining yet again. This is our final sprint to the finish. And what I hope we'll do today is make enough of progress so that we can get you a draft of our recommendations for this week's homework. So we'll try to put a draft together at the close of this week and then spend next week going over the draft to make any last minute changes, because our final product is due on next Thursday or Friday. Can't remember which. So we've got 1 week.
Are we out of business then?
And then we're out of business. You're right, Clem. We're done. They're shutting us down.
Well, don't speak too soon. You never know.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, or they may revive us with a different charge. So we're going to go through a bunch of topics today, and they're up on the board now. So it's really to think some more about creating a list of data elements that ought to be associated with each data element as it goes through the USCDI process, which for the lack of a better term, called the biography of the data element. And we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk about feedback for the final recommendation. So to start that off, I think, can I have the next slide, please? All right, so I think let me go through the slides that we're going to look at very quickly and very high level, so we can then come back and tackle each stage in a little bit more detail. But I think it would be helpful if we just sort of get to see the scope of what we're thinking about today rather than dive into each particular stage. So with that for intro, let me go through what we're proposing. So again, we're proposing so far a 6-stage process for moving data classes from a stage of being proposed through to final recognized national deployment. And so 6 stages overall. And the first stage is the one of having the data element or data class proposed by any stakeholder or stakeholder groups. And the intent is to open the process of proposing data elements to the broadest group of stakeholders possible without any barriers for making a proposition. And to support this process, we're going to need a shared platform that allows any user to take a look at what's been proposed, by whom, with what value, what data set, what data elements, and basically allow coalitions of stakeholders to form around groups of data elements or a data class in order to support the value of that class moving forward. So that's sort of a summary of stage one. Stage two is once you've got a group of data elements yet to be a real data class that's identified with sufficient value, then it moves into sort of the preparation phase. And then this is the phase in which a lot of critical work has to be done. And the critical work includes specifying what actually is in the data class, clearly defining the data elements to be included, and then identifying the standards that can and should be associated with that data class. And then finally, some work of harmonization. So if there are similar data elements or data classes that are used by multiple entities, think clinical care versus regulatory versus quality reporting versus what public health needs. They may all need similar data elements, but may define them differently. So the process of harmonization so that a single set can meet a diverse population of needs gets done in this stage. So a lot of work. This is a very complicated stage. The next slide, please. Let's see, were we just going to talk about stages one and two, or are we going to go through all four? I guess, Adam, that's a question for you.
Totally up to you. I thought it might be easy to give the full six-stage picture view okay. At the beginning and then go back have a discussion.
Okay. Yep, good. So do we have slides for stages three? Here we do. Yes, we do. Great. Okay. So emerging status. This is the old, one of the original statuses proposed in the initial ONC draft. And this is basically a sufficiently defined data class that it can be tested in limited settings. And the idea is to road test it, find out where the gaps are, do the modifications, revise, retest, revise, retest, until the data class is sufficiently tight that someone can deploy it essentially in stage four in a commercial, really in a broad commercial setting. And once it gets fully tested in stage four, with again the same issues of identifying gaps, identifying issues, mitigating them, making changes, retesting. The data class, you know, is bulletproof and ready to be handed over for anyone who finds value in it to deploy it. So those are sort of the stages. That's stage five. That gets you into the USCDI. And the way you get out of the USCDI is when it's recognized that the data class has been widely deployed. And we've got some suggestions about how that might happen, the most promising one being that we use the RCE under TEPCA to measure data flow and to sort of measure it remotely. So that's the overview of the six stages. So let's go back to the beginning. There we go. Okay. So let's pause here for a minute and entertain comments from anyone about anything. What do you think of those Red Sox? Clem.
So it looks like the stage five is the point at which they might be pushed. You're saying a policy lever is used to promote widespread adoption. And so that is what is the important stage. And so depending on how hard the first five stages are, I might like them or not. I mean, the first four stages, that is, you know, if there are such high bars that it's already done before there's an encouragement, then I might have had to soften them. But anyway, it's clear and live now.
No, and let me explain. So once we go through, get Rich's comment, and then I'll come back to something we need to discuss, and that's thinking about, in a sense, different levels of interoperability, which may get to your point about the bar being too high. So keep that thought. We'll come back to it immediately. Rich?
Yeah, thanks. So good job on this. Just a couple of thoughts. One is that the use cases which are proposed in stage two, I think it's important that there be the same sort of rigor around the use cases there is around the data class. And ultimately, in a later stage, that is determining of which developers need to implement this. I mean, if it isn't applicable to a use case you support, or if it's, you know what I mean? So that was point one. And then later on in the discussion, I think it was chart four maybe, or stage four, there was a reference to maybe one commercial system. I'm just wondering if this is to be used for interoperability, if we don't need to broaden that slightly to more than one system.
Great. No, good comments. And I guess let's just toss that back out to the group. Are we testing? Is it getting enough testing and enough exposure, or too much testing? And I don't know what the balance is. So, your proposal makes perfect sense to me. Anyone else with thoughts on that?
Well, this is Clement. So it's not just the number of vendors. It might be some sort of industry agreement. I don't know how to say it, though. And these are the tough things, finding these edges where there's some actual push. So on the one hand, we don't want to make it so hard that you don't push them until they're all already completely used everywhere. But you don't want to make it so easy that you got stuff people can't really use. But, I mean, there's maybe something, just not the industry employing it, but, some support from professional societies or industry in general, that there are certain things that are going on with fire and that seems to be industry support. And it wouldn't have to be tested in it necessarily more, there's an additional dimension if people are cheering it on or they want to have it happen. Although you want to see it working somewhere.
Right. Yep. So, anyone else with thoughts? Leslie.
Yeah, thanks. I think what Clem's trying to get to is a good idea. It's sort of an endorsing body that's not the sponsoring organization. So someone has vetted this with another industry organization to just say that they are also an interested party.
It might be federal agencies too. CDC wants to use something.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Or a quality improvement organization says, "Yeah, we're moving towards this, but not sponsoring."
Basically. Yep. Basically, the idea that not only, are you enthusiastic, but you go out and you kind of meet with your colleagues and other interested parties and you try to drum up support, essentially, co-sponsor.
Right.
Yeah.
But perhaps not as much as a sponsor, but an endorse. Yes, we agree with this direction.
Yeah.
You guys are all raising a very interesting point. It points to how political in the sense that it requires consensus among multiple parties at multiple stages. So it's a political process in that it requires consensus to move ahead.
Well, consensus is stronger than having support. Consensus means everybody agrees, and then by that time it'll already be being used. So, I mean, there's this challenge about trying to encourage it, because standards hardly ever happen without a little bit of push because everybody's busy doing something else. But on the other hand, you don't want to have some raw thing that's no one, there's no good. being pushed. I mean, there's a whole lot of standards in the first round of it, meaningful use. They weren't being used. It was the meaningful use made them use. And none of the stuff Medicare pushes was being used. They just said, this is what you're going to use. And it got used.
Right. Yeah. And that just shows you one of the barriers to adoption is pushing standards that have no value to anyone.
I wasn't saying that. No, they got done.
They got done.
If there isn't a push, there isn't enough kind of concurrence to get enough value out of them.
Yeah, okay. All right. So, any more comments? This is very helpful.
I mean, there's some other things that aren't on that section. It's like, I'm not sure what you mean by elements. I'm not sure you're saying they should, you know, say if you got something like SNOMED, are you going to say you got to list the whole set of SNOMED codes that you want to use? And when you get to, I'm not sure what you mean by these elements and definitions.
Yeah, let me respond to that, and then Rich will come back to you. So the idea of separating data elements from data classes is that, as you recall, in the proposed data classes, some of them are a single data element, you know, gender, sexual identity, age, so name. The point was that you could propose a data element, you know, aka a data class, and that's fine. And I can go into this big long list and place where people can look at it. But there might be a group of people who come by and say, you know, if we took several of these data elements together, we could create a data class with broader value to a broader number of stakeholders. So that's the reason sort of parse data class into its component parts. And I think, as you mentioned, the implication of that is if you're going to build a composite data class built of many data elements, that does each data element has to be highly specified if it's going to be interoperable. And so the answer to your question is yes, there probably does have to be a listing of the SNOMED codes or the LOIN codes.
Let me clarify. I wasn't really asking that question. I was asking what you meant by elements. I think you answered it. So that an element could be the attributes, you know, there's attributes within coding systems. And I wasn't sure which element you meant. But on the other hand, I don't think you should encourage much single element because, like, if you wanted to have a new diagnosis, the answer would go to SNOMED and get it put in.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's an issue about how much we encourage one-offs when a class has been accepted and there's some organization that deals with them. You want to put a new drug in, you know, go to RxNorm or something like that.
Right. All right. You know, and I think what's going to happen if we have data elements, the meaning of which is universally shared, that what we end up creating, in a sense, is a data element library that people can go back to and recombine to create data classes, most of which have already been standardized. If you just need, you know, might need another 15% of new data elements standardized in order to create a new class with new value to new stakeholders, but not requiring all the rework of the original class.
Might you not ask also if they've looked before they request a new one?
Yes. Yeah. I think that gets in stage two. I think that's part of the huge work that has to get done in stage two. Exactly.
So going back to elements has got so many specialized meanings. You might be better off with data items or data terms or data something else than elements. I'd like to hear other people speak to that.
With data fields or data attributes, Mark?
Well, attributes are like part of a record, and these things are the record instances, I think, that we're talking about.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. What does someone need to know in order to share a piece of information that can be understood and reused by the receiver? What are you calling that? Items, attributes?
I'd call it a term. Well, in survey instruments, they call them items. The separate questions in a survey instrument. But you get drugs, which may not be called items. You know, I don't know. Or might be useful to have sort of an introductory discussion about what's there and what things, drugs are, you know, prescribable drugs are considered a class probably by everybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, list some of the things that are there and encourage folks to go to those organizations that support them to get more of them or something like that. Because you can't just get any drug you want. They're just what's available, you know, legally.
But when I want information on a medication, like I may want the medication name, I may want the ingredient level, I may want the strength, the dose, the frequency, the start date, the stop date. Like, to me, those are all the additional items that go with that class. Where did the data come from? Did it come from the field, from the pharmacy? Did it come from prescribing? Like, does all of that go into this, or is that another phase?
Good question.
Yeah. You know, I think the way that I've been thinking about that, which may be wrong, is that may be, there may be sort of nested use cases that we're talking about, and each use case requires a slightly more specification than the preceding one. So a list of drug names without, you know, doses or ingredients or administration times or lifetime use, whatever else you want to know. That might be one use case, and another one might be, you know, we need to make this available so we know what the next dose is that we have to give, because we need to know the time and the amount and so on. So I've been thinking about it as sort of nested use cases rather than
this also gets back to introductory sort of educating the users, you know. So we're talking about the first case, we're talking about, you might see, coding systems. Then now we're talking about message structures, I think effectively, or data structures.
Yeah.
So I really think it'd be important to say, if you really want to see about data structures in medication, go to the script standard, go to the HL7 inpatient V2 medication standards or the FHIR standards. Those are sort of done, and that takes care of all that complexity. The coding system is what I thought we mostly were thinking of when we were talking about data classes, you know, but I don't know.
This is Kim. I guess I'm struggling with this a little bit because let's just take the medication example, and you just have the medication name. And whether you're using this for primary use or secondary use, but let's say it's for primary use, you get the medication name, but it was a medication that's not even active on the patient's profile anymore. Like, that's important to know. So I'm confused with what we're saying with these data classes and what to exchange if we can't give all the context that needs to go with them for people to make decisions off of them, either at a primary point of care or from a secondary analysis.
And sorry, this is Lauren, just quickly. Terry, I just want to jump in. I see Rich and Leslie have been in the queue, so just want to acknowledge they have a comment or question.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I'm missing some reason. I'm not getting the queue anymore.
So I believe Rich was first, and then Leslie, and then was that Nancy who was just speaking?
It was Kim.
Kim.
Okay, so then we can go Rich, Leslie, and then Kim.
Okay, so I wanted to get back to the conversation that we were having a little bit earlier. There was some discussion about stakeholder and political support for, you know, particular data classes and whether to move them forward. And I just want to make sure we don't conflate that with, you know, technical feasibility established and proven. And that's where I was thinking the one commercial vendor ought to be something more. And I don't think we nailed that down, but I think it's important that there's, or maybe it's not a commercial vendor, maybe it's two different developers, just generically, that are proving this. So it's not just, you know, a single instance.
All right, and okay, and who's up next? Leslie, are you up next?
So the way I think of this is we're not replacing standards organizations. We are allowing someone to pick up a bucket of standards or data class of standards and say, hey, this is ready to be considered for prime time. And we're not going to come back and ask for USDI to take I think as few times as possible, we want to say this is a single knit in all the standards. We want to say there's a class of services called drugs, and the use cases that have been reviewed indicate all of these fields are necessary in one or more use cases, as Kim just described. So this class and these definitions and these use cases are ready for prime time. We want to pick it up, stick it in the US CDI process, and we can demonstrate that we not only have a sponsor, and it might be Kim's organization, but she's already spoken with several other organizations that have both primary and secondary uses of that data to gain support. And then after that's gone through a process of technical feasibility, and it says, yes, we're ready to have that considered for regulatory needs, it might get through once, and then it evolved because that use case that was part of that data class recommendation gets some new needs. And that new evolution might skip to stage four that says, that class called drugs now has a new use case. As a result of it, we have four more data elements involved. We still have the primary sponsor, and those who have both secondary and primary interest in this use case are on support of this, that's ready for prime time. So I'd hate to have us be a replacement for standards, but more as a place to consider that standards are ready for regulatory consideration. And therefore, we're not approving or disproving, or approving or not, data elements and definitions. We're approving whether or not this data class has met technical, political, and sponsorship needs in order for it to be ready for regulation or rules.
I like that.
Right. Let's hope that's recorded. Thank you. Yeah, and I think, you know, we'll be a consumer of standards, but we're not going to be a creator of standards.
Correct.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Anybody else out there? Okay, then let me throw something else by you and see if this makes any sense, any value, or whether we just want to scrap it. But for a variety of reasons, it seems to be, we're thinking of interoperability is really operating in three different levels of sophistication based on sort of what the stakeholder needs, their access to IT, the cost of acquiring, storing, sharing data, that we're thinking of sort of three levels of interoperability. One, so basic, intermediate, and advanced are the three. And for basic interoperability, we're saying this is a group that essentially uses fax and email as their primary exchange modes. And that they really need is they just need a document with unstructured data. All they need is to know that the document is containing what they think they're getting when they ask for the document. They're getting a document of medications, and the expectation is the medication document will contain XYZ. And they're not going to use semantic standards. They're not going to use fancy transport standards. But they derive huge benefit from the data from the unstructured data, but really derive no additional benefit from any structure. So call those people the basic users. And that's really all of LTPAC, home and community-based services, most likely the individual for a while. So there's huge value in the data, but not much value in the structure, which adds cost. And then there's a group of intermediate users who can benefit from structured, semantically standardized data that they know means what they want it to mean because they've got to share it with regulatory bodies or payment systems or quality improvement reporting. So they need some structure around their data that needs to be specified and well-defined, but they may not need the type of transport exchange that allows them to manipulate the data further than just knowing that they have data in a standardized form. And then the third group are sort of the advanced folks. These are all the meaningful use people who spent billions of dollars putting in certified EHRs who have the capability of producing and consuming machine-readable data or data that they can parse into their systems. And they really need the whole ball of wax. They need the applicable standards, both transport and semantic, and they need to have them constrained enough so that what they're receiving is actually interoperable. So that's the overview of sort of a worldview about interoperability. And the implication of this is that there's a big class of folks who are going to be happy with unstructured data. And to the extent that we can facilitate that data moving rapidly, it puts things like clinical notes and radiology reports and anything that can be shipped as an unstructured text or picture, it puts that essentially on a fast track and says, okay, well, let's move this along because it has value to a bunch of stakeholders. And it may not take as much work as all this semantic stuff, all this standards work that we're going to have to do otherwise. So let me throw that out there for the group.
So I agree with what you're saying, but I don't think that you're saying that it's quite right. That is, if you're talking totally unstructured, it's done. People are sending email and they're getting mail and they're getting faxes. We have nothing to deal with that. You're talking about getting notes and reports where the payload is unstructured. You can't get away without having some structure on top of it to know who the patient is, to file it, wherever you're going to put it, to know what the test is if it's a radiology report. You won't know where to put it. Unless you're just doing it all by hand, then back to why do you need anything? Just, take it in and read it and put it where you want to. So help me with that, getting that distinction. But I like the idea of focusing on where the payload is unstructured. It's fast track.
Yeah, so, all right, let's think some more about how can we advance interoperability moving unstructured payload, and what would it take? What's the structure that it would take to do that?
They exist.
And Terry, I do see a comment or a question from you.
Oh, from Kim?
Yeah. Hi. So Terry, the way I heard what you were saying, and correct me if I misunderstood it, was that you were saying the data could look different, the data classes could look different depending on the user. And so I would almost flip that and say if the data class, let's just take medications because that is in a fairly structured format with standards today. Like, if that's already there, then it should be in that structured format no matter who the user is. But then there are other data classes that you were talking about, like with radiology, those patient goals and things that are important for other users to receive. And it would be good to have that payload, as y'all were talking about, to be able to have that exchange for different users to view and use if they needed it. So that's kind of how I see it. Like if the data class is already structured, like everybody should be doing that, because if you don't, then you're going to have somebody who has it unstructured and then one day somebody who needs it structured, and they're not going to be able to send it that way. Do you know what I mean?
I think so. Yeah, I guess the question would be, are there broad swaths of healthcare where A, structure doesn't add a whole lot, and B, they're not in a position to structure the data necessarily, unless they just copy what they get from somebody else who did structure it. Again, thinking about LTPAC and home and community-based services primarily.
Terry, since I don't see that we have a slide on this, can you reiterate what your middle stage was?
Yeah, and again, this is probably the fuzzier of the three stages, as if the first one is properly defined. And that was a group of users who need standardized data, so structured, semantically standardized data, but don't really have a way of manipulating it because they just don't have the IT capability. And again, you can think of a lot of post-acute care where they have limited IT capability. And that includes, you know, LTACs and IRFs and home health agencies. And there's a benefit to them because they can reuse structured data to meet a bunch of their reporting needs, but don't really have the systems like the eligible providers who can, you know, parse that data, reanalyze it, run decision support off it.
But it seems like you're setting up two different levels for the data classes to be stored just based on the user. And so let's take that LPAC one. So maybe they don't have it in a structured format, but they at some point they may need to send information to another provider or to a hospital that's taking care of that patient, and it's going to be in a text format, or if a researcher wants to do research on that and it's all in a text or a blog format, then they're not going to be able to do what they need to do. So you're setting up two different standards for the data classes, right?
Right, and the reason for that is that receiving unstructured data has more value than not receiving any data at all. I think that's the trade-off. Would you rather not receive it?
Yeah, I agree with that, but if you have a data class that's been defined in a structured way, why would you allow some people to do it in an unstructured way and some people are forced to do it in a structured way to where you're getting two different levels of data? I'm getting confused on that.
It has to do with how they are able to exchange that information or make it available, and that's part of it. They may not have any more sophisticated way of making the data available than, you know, secure email attachment. in which case it's whatever's in the payload. It's whatever structure's in the payload. It's not what they've done to manipulate the data. Anyway, am I answering your question? I'm not sure.
Well, you're helping me understand what you're saying. I'm still drawing a little bit of a blank. And I guess if it's, are you considering the LPAC? Like, they're care providers, right?
Yep.
But I don't know. In my mind, I'm thinking of them that they would need to have their medications in a structured format with a RX norm code and using the same standards to be able to exchange that, because they're part of the whole care team. And if you couldn't exchange that in a fluid way, that seems to be going against where we're trying to go.
Yeah, no, I think in the ideal world, everyone would have everything structured and have wonderful EHR platforms that enable all of this. But I think the reality is that that's never going to happen. I think there are going to be parts of healthcare that are providing clinical care that will never acquire the IT sophistication needed to either create or send structured data. I mean, I just think that's the reality.
So this is Eric. I have my hand up. Just want to chime in that I couldn't agree more that structured data is our imperative. Non-structured data is difficult to parse, to understand, to make sense of, and it is, bottom line, not interoperable. So I couldn't agree more with the opinion that all data possible that can be structured, you know, should be structured. Period. If organizations cannot provide that, then they already are non-interoperable.
This is Christina.
Agreed.
I think Kim brings up an excellent point. And when I was originally thinking of this, I was thinking if data is available, we should make it available. But now this is a kind of taken a different path in the discussion. It's not as available. So I think this is important. Yeah, you guys just made me think. Because, Terry, I think like we were thinking, let's get it out there in how it's available today, but then we still need to continue to progress forward. And if there are more robust form ways to exchange, then those should be the requirements, right?
Well, it all comes down, I think, to the use cases. Again, if our use case is to allow data to be processed and read by humans for human consumption for individualized treatment, then a fax or an email or unstructured content achieves that to an extent, not efficiently. But if our use case is, you know, personalized medicine, population health, analytics to try to determine new optimal path treatment pathways, then those objectives are not accomplished, in my non-clinical opinion, unless the data is structured and augmented by non-structured data only to the extent that additional information cannot be conveyed in structured format.
So Leslie's been patiently waiting. So Leslie, you want to chime in?
Yeah, this is a hard one. I struggle with this because by nature of saying it's all structured, then we have a have and a have-not society in a process that is designed to serve as many people in the country as possible. Whether it's the single guy in Rupert, Idaho that takes care of 500 patients, or whether it's Beth Israel Deaconess. So there is a natural tension here that I think Terry's point is trying to acknowledge. Look, they're going to have varying degrees of technical capacity. Eric's point is, well, then it's not ready for prime time for regulation. And perhaps what this identifies, rather than us making a black and white decision about this, to say that part of this preparation would indicate the the capacity to adopt across the continuum in today's technology as part of the due diligence process. Because sometimes government will choose the floor and sometimes government will choose the ceiling. If we have a Zika catastrophe, they're going to choose the ceiling. If we have something that says this is a nice to have, we might be choosing the floor, and it might actually be a direct message with a consolidated CDA payload that has to be manually ingested into the EHR. So we have an obligation to accommodate the floor and the ceiling as part of due diligence and not state that it has to be one or the other if our objective is to serve all in the country.
I like the way you said that, Leslie. I guess with that being said, we know there's going to be different technical capabilities with different caregivers, but then I think there's also the thought of with the data classes, some of them today have very structured formats through standards, and some of the things only have a blob or have text that can be sent. And I think it's good for us to say if it can be sent as a blob and that information is helpful, we should help as this group facilitate that being possible through a standard with all the attributes that Clem was talking about earlier to say who it's from, what it is, you know, to identify it in the proper way so that it can be consumable to the end user. And I think it's important that we do have unstructured data that we could push through here, but it does have to be encapsulated with a standard somehow. But I don't personally feel that if we have a data class that has standards with structure that we should be pushing it to be sent in an unstructured format.
I don't know whether there's other hands up, so let me know if I can join in.
So we have
your next, Clem.
Okay. So I think we're getting some things confused a little bit. So I think what Terry was pushing for was having payload to this narrative. And there's no problem with that. But I think if you think of it as people have no technical capability, they can't do any of this. I mean, you can't send stuff. You'll never get it in. They can either send faxes or they can send emails. That's all done. We don't have to help. But you got to have a standard, as just heard from Kim, anyway. And probably they could also take more structured stuff, but that's not the big issue. But if we just declare these are in between people and somehow they don't have much capability and somehow it'll work, it won't work. There's got to be a floor on the capability before they can do anything with the payload being unstructured.
So this is Adam from ONC. This is a terrific discussion. It is 4:20. I would recommend that we perhaps move on to the next slides on stages 3 and 4. And also note that I think there might be a loud typer who is not on mute. So if you wouldn't mind putting yourself on mute while you're not talking, that would be great. Thank you. Terry, back to you.
Hey, Terry, do we want to focus on the stage slides or go more through the biography of a data element, which we probably haven't discussed yet as much? Did we lose Terry?
No, you didn't lose me. I was just talking on mute. But I wasn't typing. Okay. sure. So that's That's fine. So let's take a look at the biography, because that's sort of another new concept. And the question is, you know, if we're going to create this shared platform where we house data elements and data classes that are advancing through this process, you know, is there a set of information about each data element that should travel with the element? And again, it's calling it its biography, for lack of anything else. And this is, these couple of slides are just a real fast draft of what, for example, some of those elements might be. But you could imagine a data element making it all the way through as part of a data class that then becomes available for reuse, and it has a pedigree attached to it. So again, this, you know, and does this help the process, or is it just a sort of a needless detour? Eric, hello. Eric, you've got the floor.
Sorry, took me a second to unmute. So the one item that struck me as being helpful to maybe add on to this excellent first draft would be the associated use cases that it's designed to support. And you do say in here value. Maybe that those concepts could be merged together, asking what's the value or what's the value to certain use cases. That this proposal is intended to augment or enhance or enable.
Great. Thanks. So add use cases to the pedigree.
Yes.
Or whatever we want to call this.
Clem and then Peter?
Clem?
Yeah, well, I think we need a lot more specification around this. So what I think we're talking about is a list of records that represent the instances of the thing you're talking about in the class. And then you're talking about the pieces of that instance or the fields in that instance record that would specify it or say what you mean. And I mean, so you're going to get a whole different record in fields. If it's talking about drugs and you're only talking about drug, you might say drug instances. Or if you're talking about labs, you get different fields. Or if you're talking, I mean, so across the space of things you're talking about, you're gonna need different record structures. And I think we need to start with some class names, actually, and then specialize within them if you wanted to go at this level. And I think the idea of asking people to put in, let's say if it's something simple like a questionnaire, you want to ask that a questionnaire should be included. I don't think the average person will have any idea how to specify. You need answers for the questions. You know, if you're doing things with numeric, you need units of measure. So I think we got to think about how we want to do this. And I think you might be better off saying this is what's out there. And if you want to do one of these kind of things, use this standard that exists to ask for another one. But I think this is very, very diffuse right now, and I wouldn't know how to use it.
Okay. Thanks, Stephen?
I'm not sure I'm answering the same question that Clem was answering, but... I mean, I think you asked, you know, is this a needless detour, or does it make sense for us to kind of flesh out this biography, this history of each of the data elements? And so I'll answer that question, and I think it does. I mean, I think this is a good idea. I think, you know, for every element that makes it into USCDI, that it makes sense to kind of have a whole set of references that talk about how it got there, who supported it, you know, what was its journey in getting there. And frankly, I would even say, even once it's up in full use, that there should be an opportunity to collect metrics, you know, on how much it's being shared and how it's being utilized and what have been the successes. I think the idea of, as you say, a biography of the data elements makes sense to me, and I like the way you're approaching it.
Okay, thank you. And Leslie.
My points were well said, the points were well said, and I would just add that in this biography, we have a biography that includes expanding an existing approved member of USCDI or expanding new stakeholders to an approved class. So making sure we have those tracks as well when we're finished.
Well, could someone do some examples of what they're talking about? Are we going to say, I want to put penicillin in, and I'm going to describe penicillin?
What I'm suggesting is, let's say there's a data class that Kim described for drugs, and that data class and all of the use cases around it didn't meet a whole new group of drugs that are coming in. It could be related to new precision medicine initiatives, for instance. And so now that class has to be expanded with these new use cases. Or that same group has said, gee, now PBMs are going to be part of this interoperability network. It's a new stakeholder that wants to participate directly with the EHRs. We've already defined these classes of service. Now we want to add these new stakeholders. So that's my example. If those new stakeholders, by virtue of adding to this, create change to USCDI or change to needed that would support regulation.
Okay. Well, the advantage of saying you're adding is something is then there's already a structure, a framework for knowing what the things you're talking about. But in your particular case, I think that's all done. I think the whole pharmacy stuff I think it's pretty well done.
I was being examples. Saying drugs or not, just as an example.
Okay. Any other thoughts, gang? You might see this in the draft.
Maybe you know, someone would create a fleshed out example set of something that really be done with this that might make it clearer and easier. Or if they can't, then I don't think then we got a problem.
I had marked up a set around immunizations, and I can't remember who proposed immunizations as a use case.
Oh, that I think that would have been me. This is Michael.
Oh, okay. So,
but I think that's done too. There's a couple of coding systems for immunizations. There's some message structures for immunizations.
But is it in regulation, Clem? The issue is not whether the standard has been used, but whether that standard is acknowledged enough to be in regulation.
It is. It actually is. It's in meaningful use. But I mean, the question
here's an example, Clem. This is Eric. Right now, one of the issues I faced in a real-world project was that experimental cancer medications are not codified. They're named based on the conventions of the study, and they're not shared, at least to my knowledge. And so one proposal could be that cancer studies that are hopefully going to be within the scope of an interoperable data exchange actually include codification of the administration or the medications as part of the project.
Yeah, okay.
The value
yeah.
would be that cancer researchers can collaborate and identify more readily around the experimental therapies being given to patients. This brings something out of the scope of non-interoperable data into something that's now interoperable, et cetera. So we could, you know, that's one concrete example I would actually like to see.
But do you have an effective procedure for getting there? Because the vendors, you know, you've got randomized. There's either a placebo or the real drug. You can't reveal that. It's a little bit
easily accomplished, I would think, in that when the study is funded, part of that includes just a map from the an arbitrary identifier, which acts as the anonymized characteristic for the a given medication. It maps back to the actual medication being prescribed, whether it's a placebo or the actual medication under study.
Okay.
But I'm certainly not a cancer researcher or a clinician, but that's just one example that occurred to me. And that was a real problem because the product I was involved with, actually, they wanted for multiple hospitals that were administering the same medication to be able to identify if the same medication was being given to the same person at a different facility, and they couldn't reconcile this.
Okay.
All right. More comments. Okay. And Adam, where are we on our journey through the slides?
I believe that up next was discussion of stages 3 and 4 on the following slide.
Okay. All right, so 3 and 4 are two of the original USCDI process stages. They're really the testing stages. And I may be wrong, but really been thinking about them as really differences in testing scale rather than differences in process. But happy to hear other thoughts about that.
Clem. Clem, did you have a comment?
I did, but I was talking to a muted speaker. Yeah, I'm not sure we need 3 and 4 separately because they could be blended. But also wanted to add a couple things to biography after I was critical of it. I think we need to say something in there as to whether these are coded data elements and whether they've looked to see what's around. And there was one other dimension. Well, there's a couple things like the higher level process things would tell people what they're asking about.
Great. Okay. To your comment about aren't these the same stage, I think one of the other purposes of stage 4 in particular is to give the vendor community a heads up with as long a lead time as possible. There are going to be candidates that there are going to be data classes that take a long time to get out of category 3 because they're going to go through multiple cycles of testing and retesting. So telling industry that they're coming sort of dilutes the impact of knowing that once you get to stage 4, you really are basically one process step away from being a national priority. So it was the value of providing industry with as long a meaningful timeline as possible that led us to keep the 2 stages. I'm sorry,
Eric, you're next.
Thanks. So I like the overall idea behind stage 3 and 4, but what I would like to suggest we do is improve the how to get out language. Right now it seems very subjective, and I would respectfully suggest we make that objective. For example, some standards bodies will use a criteria for their equivalent of a stage 3 that says this has been, say, piloted by 3 different organizations using different technologies. And that perhaps could be an extra criteria for stage 3. And stage 4, more objectively, perhaps they could have a criteria such as it has been implemented in production by at least three organizations using different technologies or some similar subjective or less subjective measure for the exit criteria?
Well, along that line, I think there is a formal maturity level goes from 1 to 5 in FHIR. I can't spit it out what it is. But we should probably look at the actual public levels.
And this is Eric. There is indeed for, I think, FHIR, and I know there is for IHE, and it actually is based on something similar to what I just conveyed, which is that we actually have, you know, a subjective threshold based on organizations that are known to have achieved a certain level of implementation status.
Okay.
Yeah, otherwise, my concern is on 3 and 4, I don't know how to measure that or how to test that.
So this is actually a proposal that Adam has been advocating. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense that we make the exit criteria very explicit, and using the maturity models that are out there as examples may help us find the right vocabulary to describe an objective exit criteria. So,
but let me highlight, though, that even when you make it objective, people exaggerate or overstate or understate. And I think how FHIR does it, I think it's a vote, you know, from but I'm not sure, which is not, it doesn't have as high objective spec, but at least, you know, with the mass of industry and people and who thinks it's ready.
Yeah, so you're suggesting we ask the stakeholders or interested parties to opine?
Well, I think I actually think what we ought to do is get the written specifications for these maturity levels from existing standards organization and think about what would work the best, or maybe many of them would work equally well. You know, if the standards body says it's a 5, maybe that's good enough, you know, rather than us having to do it. I don't know.
Yeah, the comment I made back to Adam was that the maturity standard, standards for standards is different than sort of the data class readiness to move on to the next stage, although they may be analogous, they're somewhat different.
Well, I think there's a lot of analogy in the FHIR one, because FHIR applies the security to what they call a resource, which would be very parallel to a data class, I think, in our world, but people ought to dig in a little bit.
Okay. All right. So the recommendation, Clem, you're saying is let's take the FHIR resource standards and see how we can apply them to stages 3 and 4 to add more objectivity.
Yeah, but I would add in, as Eric suggests, you know, look at IHU. I don't think we have to target immediately just one, but just get a sense of what's there and how to use it, how it could really be used. Yes, I more or less said that.
Okay. And Kim, you're on deck. You're up.
Yeah, I had something back on stage 1 and 2, so I don't want to interrupt the stage 3 and 4. So when we're done with that, if you'll call on me again, I'll go back to that.
Okay. All right. So Leslie's the only other one in the queue. So Leslie, are you
rather than first? I think rather than say we're going to use or identify this maturity model as being the one we consider, we just simply state that as part of this consideration, you've identified a maturity model associated with the standards named. When one doesn't exist, here is what the USCDI will consider.
Okay.
But to the degree possible, we don't want people to redo work they've just done to get a standard elevated within the standards body organization. We want to be able to package it in a way that says it's ready for regulation.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. Right. Again, we're not advancing standards. We're looking for standards that support the data class to be advanced. Okay. Kim, you're back.
Okay. Thank you. So I'm a little bit of a slow processor, and I hope my processing capabilities are working right. But when I look at stage 1 on slide 4, it said proposed data elements, and then all the rest of them talk about the data class, and then it defines a data element as part of the data class. So is that the correct terminology on slide 4 to use data element, or is it data class? And then on slide 5, at the title, it also says the biography of a data element. Shouldn't that be a data class, and then the elements are just part of that class? Or I don't know. I'm just thinking if somebody else is looking at this and they're trying to relate each of those things, like I would get caught up on that.
Yep. And I think that goes to a lot of Clem's points, too, of sort of what are we calling, what's the data element?
I think she's got a good point. I would call them items, right, because it's fairly generic. But the key is, though, that you got to be careful about talking about the class and the child of the class as the same thing, although there are such things as singleton classes. That's, I think, what Kim is pointing to, and we got to be consistent.
Yeah, so we're talking about children of the class?
Well, these items are probably children, but it just gets the world confused. You get like an Escher diagram if they become the same.
Yeah, right. Okay. All right. Okay, good points, and we will take that under advisement. We'll see what we can come up with in one day. Okay, Eric, you're up.
Just very briefly to close the loop on the prior discussion about the exit criteria, I've included in the chat two links, one to a informal discussion of the IHE maturity model for moving something from essentially trial to final tech status, another one for the FHIR maturity model. They speak, very much in terms of the lingo of the standards bodies, but perhaps it would give us some materials to draw from. One criteria, for example, would be has this been tested at an industry test event? Another one is, are there test tools available? Has it been deployed in production? Has it been deployed in prototype environments? Are significant change proposals issued against that where there's presumably a problem? And have those actually all been addressed and so on? Anyway, that might inform this work.
Yeah, no, that's great. That helps. And that might apply to stage 2 as well. Yeah, how do you get out of stage 2? You may need to have some of those things in place.
Yeah, exactly. This is just to inform what may be a little more objective entry and exit criteria for the various stages. And this is the good thing about basing our work to extend on those particular items is they've been battle proven. These maturity models have been tested over many years and refined, and they work within those realms.
Great. Yes, I think that's a good suggestion. All right, so here we are. Maybe at this point, if someone has any more comments, just put your hand up and break in and make them. But perhaps we ought to take a look at the upcoming homework, which is going to be kind of daunting. Do we have a homework slide, Adam? I don't.
We do not have a homework slide.
Okay. Then we'll make it up.
Does that mean it's not daunting?
Yeah, that's right. That means it's not yet daunting. But it will be when we make up the slide. We've got to get our final recommendations in by the end of next week, which means our meeting on Wednesday and our homework are the last two times that we're going to be able to materially change the presentation. So it means that whatever goes out on Thursday of next week is what's going to get presented the following week in DC. So with that in mind, I think the homework for this weekend is going to be to take a look at the drafts and get out your red pencil and just sit down and mark it up. And again, it doesn't things that bother you, things you think are missing, things you think are wrong, things that aren't emphasized enough or emphasized too much. You know, just have at it. And, you know, our job will be to take those comments and produce a redraft that we can discuss. Again, we'll try to get that out to you early next week, a redraft, so that we can discuss and make final changes on Wednesday. So how does that sound for a timeline, Eric? You have your hand up, or are you on mute?
Yes, I was double muted, sorry. Yeah, that sounds good. And I just have two requests. One, can that be sent out to us sooner rather than later? And two, can that be sent in an editable format so we can actually return it with markup in place or something efficient like that? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So we can send it out as a, you know, as a Word file with track changes. Or whatever Adam and Stacy are most comfortable dealing with.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Yep. Our goal is to try to get it out on Friday, but we do have to – we've been working in just a Google Doc, and we have to put it into a template. So just bear with us. I'm hoping Friday. And then – I was thinking, would it be helpful to send out the biography of a data element, lack of better words, putting in data element, but would it be helpful to send that out to the group and get comments on that earlier? I think that's the only thing that's really new that we've introduced on today's call. And we can probably send that along with the immunization example out.
But I got to remember, Eric, the immunization example, it's completely done. And if you're not at least referencing that, I think you're going to confuse everybody. I mean, we should know that kind of stuff if we're representing high tech.
So, Christina, well, yes, to your question, this is Eric. If you can send out partial information for us to start working on early, that would be very helpful.
Terry and Christina, this is Lauren. If there's nothing else, we could go to public comment, or we could, if you need more time for discussion in the next 5 minutes or so, it's up to you.
Why don't we go to the
This
public
is Leslie.
Comment?
Could I make one comment? I think that what's confusing is, like, Clem's point, you know, we say, okay, well, this class we should consider that that's already done. Maybe the use case is something like, oh, quality measurement organization and CMS have been collaborating to determine this particular change for on behalf of patient safety. And so there's new quality measure being initiated. This quality measure has data elements that are already in standards bodies, and here's what they are, and here's the use case today. We think this use case could be applied to this new need, and therefore we're bringing this in so that regulation can be considered at a future date. I think the process has to be one that aligns with a use case need. There's a new business need, and I think we keep trying to say, well, is this the right data element to consider, or is this the right data class to consider, when what we're really saying is there's a new business need for the government that may be considering regulation and or rules, and they want to align that so that standards can be promoted, adopted, and used to scale.
I like that clarification.
Yeah. Excellent point. And remember when we originally sent out the homework assignment to go through the different stages, and Michael sent the immunization, we weren't asking where it was. I mean, it just shows that it's going to be further along, probably making it more to stage six. So keep that in mind, too, as you're looking at the immunizations. It's just an example of how it would work in the process, not something that we need to propose.
Well, would it be, because there's going to be a whole spectrum of people looking to load this in, and I want to come back to why can't we give them like a couple paragraphs of what exists and where they could look at it to see if it's sufficient.
So Clem just raised his hand to draft that for us.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Well, I'm bugging me.
Yes, sir. We'll send you out a reminder tonight. All right. If there are no other comments from us, why don't we go to a public comment, and then we'll, any time that's left, we'll still doing something.
Great. Operator, can you please open the line for a public comment?
If you would like to make a public comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press *2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Thank you. And just to remind everyone to please keep your comments to no more than 3 minutes. While we're waiting for folks to dial in, I just want to go back to the attendance to confirm, do we have either Brett, Valerie, Nancy, or Dan on the line? Okay. We'll just record them as being absent. And operator, do we have any comments in the queue at this time?
There are no comments in the queue at this time.
Okay. Thanks. So with that, I'll turn it back to Terry.
Okay. All right, gang. We got 6 minutes for any more comments on anything that's still top of mind.
If nothing else, we can adjourn for the day. And just to remind everyone that our next call will be at 3:30. I'm sorry, was that a comment? Okay, maybe not.
No. Great.
Terry,
okay.
We'll adjourn.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Have a good night.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye.